A local lawmaker makes waves in Tallahassee and the future of independent film. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Representative Omari Hardy knows he and his party face an uphill battle in Tallahassee.
Democrats will be in the minority as long as we continue to act like we're in the minority. You have to stand up and show the people of Florida why you're different from the other side.
He'll share his thoughts on police reform, social justice, and his future in politics. Also, how much do you know about your local and state lawmakers or about upcoming elections? We're going to learn about a couple of apps developed locally focused on keeping people civically engaged and keeping the government accountable. And finally, O Cinema in Miami celebrates a decade in business. Could the future of independent film be connected to virtual reality? All of that today on Sundial, after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for joining us. Palm Beach County State Representative Omari Hardy has developed a reputation as a bull in the legislature. The freshman Democrat has consistently challenged Governor Ron DeSantis and Republicans on criminal justice, voting rights, and equitable vaccine distribution. He's amassed hundreds of thousands of followers on Instagram and Twitter. Hardy has been compared to New York Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in Congress for his unwavering commitment to progressive ideals. We spoke to Hardy this morning at the start of the final week of the legislative session about his ambitions in Tallahassee and beyond. What did last week's guilty verdict of Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd mean in the context of national conversations about police brutality for you?
I think the guilty verdict was necessary to keep people from losing any hope that they might have in this system. So I am relieved that we got the guilty verdict. It was what both George Floyd and Derek Chauvin deserved. But frankly, the kind of justice that we want is the justice that would have had George Floyd here with his family. So the guilty verdict, we're relieved to have it, but ultimately we want to build a world, you know, in America in which Black men are no longer being killed by the police for no reason at all.
How do you take this moment, though, and try to lead the country in that direction? How do you take this verdict and try to get to that point?
Well, I think you have to remember that behind that verdict is a tragedy. And I'm happy that we have the verdict, but I don't want us to feel as though we accomplished something. The back half of the criminal justice system worked, but the front half, and that's the part of the criminal justice system that Derek Chauvin participated in when he was a police officer, that did not work. That's why we were there. And so, you know, we're relieved to have the guilty verdict, but we have to continue to fight for real justice. We have to continue to fight to transform policing and public safety as we know it. And that's what I'm going to be focused on going forward.
And you've introduced two different bills this session focused on changing criminal justice. One of them drastically changes oversight of the police and sheriff's department. Help me understand how that works.
Well, oversight is important, and that's more of the back end. Oversight means that if you are a public employee, you should be accountable to the public. You should not be accountable to your internal affairs department. You should not be accountable to your buddies, your coworkers who are, your fellow officers, but you should be accountable to the public. And so my oversight and transparency and accountability bill basically would create in each county an oversight commission for all the police departments, as well as the sheriff department in that county. And basically that oversight commission would be composed of individuals who are civilians, who are not police officers and who do not have police officers in their immediate family. And it would be their jobs to hear and adjudicate complaints against the police. And they would have the ability to reprimand the police officer who has been found basically guilty of non-criminal misconduct. That reprimand could be anything from a suspension to a termination or a revocation of that police officer certification here in the state of Florida.
And then the other one is it seeks to unbundle police, sending responsibilities like traffic enforcement to other agencies. How could moving like traffic enforcement away from police potentially prevent incidents like what we saw with Dante Wright in Minneapolis or Corey Jones here in Palm Beach County 5 years ago?
Well, most of our interactions with police officers start with a traffic stop. And many of the unwarranted police killings that we've seen, you know, whether it's Dante Wright or whether it's Philando Castile or whether it's Sandra Bland, they started with a traffic stop. And I believe that police officers are overqualified to write people tickets for running at a stop sign or for running a red light. The fact of the matter is you can have a person who is not perform that function. And if you do that, you can still preserve the public safety interest in traffic enforcement while also preventing the potential for escalation when the police officer pulls someone over. And to be able to accomplish both of those, that's possible. As a matter of fact, it's done in other countries. So, you know, folks who say, oh, it's impossible. No, it's very possible. We just have to think outside of the box that we've put ourselves in here in America. We have to challenge the status quo.
If I may, when you look at that one, forget about what other countries you see it. There are arrangements already in cities in this country, like across Florida, where they shift those responsibilities to other people. There are programs, St. Petersburg and Sarasota, one in Oregon. And as you're well aware of, this, unlike other countries, this is an armed society. So oftentimes these calls, be it for a mentally ill person or traffic stop, can be dangerous. So how do we navigate away from using police in all situations and still have to deal with that danger that's always a possibility?
Well, we have to acknowledge what the data show about traffic stops and the danger narrative around traffic stops. The data show that traffic stops are extremely safe for police officers. The data also show that when traffic stops become unsafe, it's because the person behind the wheel knows that they're coming into contact with a law enforcement officer. It's typically because that person either has a warrant out for their arrest or has something in their car, like drugs or what have you, that they should not have. And as the police officer is walking to the car, they make a decision that they're not going to jail today. And that's what causes those stops to be dangerous. And so if you remove the criminal justice aspect out of traffic enforcement and make traffic enforcement just about traffic enforcement, then immediately those stops become less dangerous. We shouldn't care about enforcing drug laws in a traffic stop. And that's what we do. And that's one of the reasons why traffic stops have become dangerous. It's this war on drugs that needs to stop. But it's also this mixing of two completely separate public safety goals, traffic enforcement and the other goals of the criminal justice system.
But you don't think, for example, if that person who maybe has a warrant may also have a weapon in the car, that they may pose a threat to this unarmed traffic enforcer?
I would say that it's not worth the many, many killings, typically of people of color that we've seen, to have a traffic enforcement officer who's armed with a gun initiating these stops in all cases. In the bill that I filed, there are circumstances in which law enforcement officers who are armed are able to make a traffic stop. When you're talking about felony stops, when you're talking about people who are driving extremely dangerously, people who have warrants out for their arrest for violent crimes, then it would be okay for a police officer to initiate that stop. But absent some evidence that the person behind the wheel is a dangerous person, I don't see a need to involve an officer who could potentially escalate the situation, just as we saw with Philando Castile, who, by the way, was armed, who was licensed to carry, who notified the officer that he was licensed to carry, just so that the officer knew and wasn't surprised, and was still shot and killed. And that officer, by the way, was acquitted, right? So what this is about harm reduction. And it's about making traffic enforcement about traffic enforcement and criminal justice about criminal justice.
I'm speaking with Democratic State Representative Amari Hardy, representing parts of Palm Beach County. We're in the final week of the legislative session in Tallahassee, with lawmakers focusing on a number of key bills before returning to their districts. You can read more of our coverage of this year's session and our series, Tallahassee Takeover, by going to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Both of your proposals never made a hearing this session. And this is the same legislature that in HB 1, preventing local governments from slashing those budgets without approval from the state. Here's the reality, the harsh reality for your party. Republicans have the House, the Senate, and the governor's office. So how do you get anything through when you are the minority?
Not by giving up before you start. Democrats will be in the minority as long as we continue to act like we're in the minority. At some point, you have to stand up and show the people of Florida why you're different from the other side. And I believe that Democrats want criminal justice reform. I believe that Democrats want to reform our policing system. And I believe that Democrats are interested in using the data to figure out what the best possible options are with respect to reforming the criminal justice system and policing. And so I recognize that in the Florida House, where there are 120 seats, Republicans have 78 of them. That is not going to stop me from proposing legislation that I think is the right legislation to move Florida forward on these critical issues that are affecting my constituents. You know, I have a district that is, majority Black, that is working class. And many of my constituents, they are afraid not only for themselves, but for their children with respect to the police in their community. And so I have to respond to that. I can't negotiate with myself. I'm going to put the best version of the ideas out there, and I'm going to look through them. And if they want to come back and negotiate, then that's when we'll negotiate.
Well,
but my constituents expect me to put the ideas out there.
But when you talk about negotiating, I mean, if they have the upper hand, you know, at what point do you say, okay, look, we got to get something. And right. And it looks like both parties are on two different sides on this issue. So negotiating already seems kind of difficult, or am I wrong?
Well, no. So we did get a negotiated bill on police reform. This is House Bill 7051. And the Legislative Black Caucus, many of us, we proposed our bills, and a lot of what we had in these bills made it into this negotiated version of the bill that is sponsored by a Republican and co-sponsored by a Democrat. This is the outcome of the legislative process over the last 60 or so days. And as a matter of fact, we heard that bill on second reading last week. I believe we're going to hear it again either today or tomorrow this week for a final vote. But we are moving the ball forward on reform. But again, if you negotiate with yourself, the final product is going to be even more moderated than probably what it should be.
So you have amassed a national profile through massive followings on Instagram and Twitter. And then there was the 60 Minutes report on the COVID vaccine rollout. Now, the governor argued against the credibility of the reporting that Black and brown lower income communities in Palm Beach County couldn't get access to doses. Do you believe the choice of Publix was politically motivated?
I think it's very reasonable to ask the question. The governor doesn't have a good relationship with the truth, and he tends not to like people who ask reasonable questions. The fact of the matter is he shouldn't call us dumb or unduly suspicious for wondering if the $100,000 in campaign contributions right before he made the decision to make Publix the sole distributor of vaccines in Palm Beach County, a county that has more seniors than any other county in the state. He shouldn't call us dumb or unreasonably suspicious for wondering if that had something to do with it. And, I certainly wondered if that has something to do with it. Lots of us wonder if that has something to do with it. The fact of the matter is only he and Publix would be able to know the answer to that question. But again, you know, this is a governor who does not have a good relationship with the truth. The fact of the matter is people of color have had and continue to have difficulty with accessing the vaccine. And, you know, when he announced that Publix partnership, the proof is in the pudding. Belgrade is 27 miles away from the nearest Publix. Folks would have had to get on two city buses to get to the nearest place where they could get a vaccine.
Just a note, we have invited the governor on the show numerous times, still waiting to hear back. I want to switch over to vaccine enthusiasm has been dipping. In Palm Beach County last week, 6,000 slots of the 16,000 in total were filled. All the people who don't have easy access to an appointment and are now hesitant anyway to get one.
It's difficult. We went from having way more demand than supply. And now supply and demand are leveling out, but there are still folks who need it and who want it and who don't quite have access. I have been pounding my fist on the table about ensuring that our incarcerated, population has access to the vaccine. There are eligible people who are incarcerated in both our county jails and in our state prisons that have not had the kinds of access that folks outside, those facilities have had. And so there are still opportunities for us to, do better outreach to folks in the community. And then there are also folks who are sick and shut in, who can't make it out. And, I think that is an opportunity for us to get the vaccine to them wherever they are. Obviously, folks have their own personal levels of comfort or discomfort with this vaccine. What I would say is that the science behind it is very strong. And I think those of us who are in elected office or who are leaders in the community in a private capacity need to do whatever we can to ensure that folks around us know that these vaccines are safe and that if you want to resume your life, the way that we were living before COVID-19, then you should go out and get one.
Look, your name has been tossed around for a lot of different opportunities and possibilities politically, and the session's about to end. I'm wondering if there is any news that you'd want to tell us. Do you have plans to run for Alcee Hastings' open congressional seat or possibly run for governor in 2022?
I am strongly considering running for Congress. I have not made a decision yet. But I believe that we need progressive voices in Congress. I believe that we need people in Congress who will challenge the status quo, folks who we don't ever have to worry or wonder if they'll fight for us. And as I look at the field, I will consider, getting into this. But I have not made any decisions yet. We're in the middle of a legislative session that is, it's a short ride in a fast machine. These 60 days in Tallahassee. Mm-hmm. So that's where my focus has been.
In this final week, do you see any bill that you want to see passed that might have a chance, or what's the priority as we wrap this session up?
I am really focused on stopping bad bills from passing. We still have a voter suppression bill that is working its way through the legislative process that we'll be hearing this week. And that will come for a final vote. And I am working as hard as I can to ensure that this thing does not pass, because I believe folks should have access to the ballot. I believe that these efforts that Republicans have been making, not just in Florida, but across the country, are about disenfranchising voters, in particular voters of color. And we have to stop it. Otherwise, we're going to lose our democracy to a second wave of Jim Crow. And it's so unfortunate. Look, we've lost John Lewis. We've lost Elijah Cummings. We've now lost Alcee Hastings. And, this is the civil rights generation that we're losing, the generation that triumphed over Jim Crow, right as Jim Crow 2.0 is rearing its ugly head. We really need to fight to stop these bad bills. That's what my focus is right now.
That was Democratic State Representative Amari Hardy representing District 88 in Palm Beach County. Read more of our reporting about this year's legislative session, including our series Tallahassee Takeover, by going to WLRN.org. Well, still to come, how much do you know about your local government? We're going to explore two new apps that focus on civic engagement. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Thanks again for joining us. Americans are increasingly becoming more interested in civics. This past year saw a big jump in the number of people who could name all three branches of government and what's included in our First Amendment rights. That's according to a USC Annenberg Constitution survey. But civics education, particularly on a local level, remains a struggle. We're going to introduce you to two apps today, developed here in South Florida. Tony Newell is the founder of ResourceCity, an app that gives users points for taking part in things like city council meetings and volunteer efforts. He's also developed CityGrader, which allows residents in Hialeah and Miami to grade city employees. Also joining us is Cesar Melgoza. He's the founder of Moxie, a politics app that teaches you about your local, state, and federal representatives. By the way, we should note Moxie is a financial supporter of WLRN, but that has no impact on WLRN News editorial decisions. Cesar, Tony, great to have you on the program today.
Pleasure to be with you, Lewis. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, Lewis.
Definitely. Cesar, I want to start with you. You live in Coral Gables. I want to look at, we got runoff elections happening tomorrow. There's another election happening in South Miami next week. How might Moxie help just the average person like me get ready for that kind of election?
Okay, well, Moxie, among many other functions that the platform supports, is elections. So there's a dedicated section of the app where anybody who onboards the platform by entering their residential address will automatically see their representatives who are currently in office and candidates for the upcoming election. So they'll see the election by date. They can click on it. And so, for example, I live in Coral Gables. As you mentioned earlier, when I open the elections page, it shows me that there's an election coming up on April 27th. Obviously, that's the runoff for City Commission groups two and three. And clicking on those buttons give you further information about the candidates. Now, each of these candidates, as well as elected officials, can claim their own presence on the platform. So the basic information is already there, and it goes into more depth for larger levels of jurisdictions, but each of the candidates can claim their page and can add more information and can create their own forum. They can create their own podcast. They can go live. They can create group chats. So they can nurture the electorate, tell them what they're proposing. And then when they become elected, if they become elected, they'll have their own page within the representatives section right of the platform as well.
Okay. So it's a chance to see who your reps are now, who's representing you on many different levels, the local, the state, and federal level, but also with upcoming elections, you could see who the candidates are and get as much information as you can on them. Where did the idea for Moxie originate?
Well, my personal background is a combination of information technology and public policy. So ever since I was in college, I was in information technology and computers. I was at Apple early in my career. I went to another firm that built market intelligence systems. I created my own company in Miami called Geoscape, which focused on media and marketing analytics. But coming back to my roots, I had dreamed up an idea of simplifying the democratic process by putting everything within the palm of your hand in an app or on your web browser, where you could get information about how your government affects you. And it starts with becoming informed. So we have a very robust news component to the platform. We also have forums on a variety of issues that you can join and you can participate in. We have podcasts. We have your elected officials. We have survey research. We have your jurisdictions, which many people don't even know what the map looks like for their own jurisdictions. You can just click a button and see that. So it's really a culmination of that together with what we're seeing today, which is there's a lot of frustration amid the public, right? Frustration, there's sometimes distrust. And so there's a desire to get real tangible information, understand what's going on, and then also, very importantly, to communicate with your elected officials to let them know how you feel about whatever legislation they're proposing.
I want to talk about a little bit how that could happen. But Tony, let me turn to you. You have, just to clarify, and I, by the way, I downloaded both of these apps to see how they would work for me and to get comfortable with them. But Tony, there's two different things going on here with you. You have Resourcity, which is the app you download, but then you have a program that's coming out soon called City Grader. I just want to make sure people understand there's two different things, right? But they're connected.
Right. That's right. So they are connected. So I'll try to give you a really truncated version here. So Resourcity is your comprehensive, all-inclusive digital hub for community. That's what we're building. The app you have today is actually a beta app that we launched in Coral Gables to test out some local loyalty features. The app that's forthcoming is going to do much more than that. And it's going to use local rewards to incentivize all types of community building activity. The three categories are community service, civic participation, and local business loyalty. City Grader is a enterprise tool that we built for local governments that is in a more narrow lane. It's dedicated to eliciting citizen feedback on local government services. But City Grader is designed to ultimately integrate with resourcing and be a part of that incentive framework.
So
they are separate, but they do dovetail later.
Sorry. City Grader, is it like, I'm just thinking the first thing that came to mind was like, rate my professor. Like, so for example, if I run into, I'm dealing with somebody from the city, and again, in any of the different agencies within the city. And my understanding is that eventually what we'll be able to do is they'll have basically one of those codes, one of those little barcodes, and then you'll just be able to download it. And then you'll be able to do a survey. You'll be able to just rate your that person's service and how they helped you, right?
That's exactly, that's fantastic, actually, because that insight there, the Rate My Professor's insight, that's how we originally built City Grader. So when we first built the solution, it was basically a Yelp for local government, where you could go online and find and go in a directory of local employees, find one and grade one based on any experience you had. We saw the way that was being used for better or worse, and decided to make some changes to the system and arrived at what we have today, which is what you described. So what will happen is local government employees will have on their business cards, for instance, in the city of Miami, you'll have building inspectors that have a QR code in the back of their building card, their business card. When that employee interacts with somebody, a member of the public, particularly out in the world where there's no record of it, there's no paper trail, they'll hand that business card to the citizen, and that citizen will be able to scan the code and take a personalized survey that aims at that employee, and send it directly back to the employee supervisor.
And then in the end, how will these two connect? Because again, as I mentioned at the beginning, is that there's the possibility that, you know what, we could go to a city council meeting, you know, make a public comment, and we might actually get points for that. And that later, you know, we can use that somewhere.
That's exactly it. So City Grader will be, every city that uses City Grader, Miami is our lead right now. We have several others going to be using it starting this summer. When ResourceCity relaunches, we will have a City Grader feature within ResourceCity. And so a user of the app will be able to click on the City Grader feature and then take any number of surveys that the city wants to create. And then in exchange for those surveys, the user will receive ResourceCity points that can then be used to redeem rewards from local businesses. So there's this little positive feedback loop we're creating. So that's exactly it. Eventually, yes, if you go to a town hall meeting, you go to a commission meeting, we'd love to see it if you when you vote, although there are concerns there. But any, most types of civic activity, you'll be able to check in, be scanned, and receive some sort of local perk.
And when will that be up?
That's coming in the fall. That's coming September, October. We're working with many organizations, both in Broward and Dade. So we're going to have a good base to launch with. And so September, October, the ResourceCity engagement platform will launch. City Grader itself as the enterprise solution will be launching with our pilot cities in June.
Well, we live in a world of apps. I mean, everything seems to be through our phone, through apps, and now we're talking about maybe that's the way to get people civically engaged. How to create more civic engagement? Maybe it's through an app. We're talking about two particular apps. One is called Moxie, created by Cesar Melgoza. The other is ResourceCity, created by Tony Newell. And again, with ResourceCity, you'll also have City Grader, and that's coming out a little bit later, as he mentioned. And we want to hear from you. How do you feel about the civic education that you received growing up? Have you needed or decided in taking and learning, you know, taking that learning into your own hands since then? Let us know on Twitter at WLRN Sundial your thoughts. We'd love to hear from you on this. You know, and of course, if you have kids, I want to know what are they teaching them in school? Because I haven't been in school in a very, very long time, and I think that the curriculum has changed quite a bit since then. We talked a lot of, as a newsroom about the need to improve civic education. Cesar, you spent years working in politics in D.C. and in Silicon Valley. What's the baseline of understanding for the average person on politics, you know, when you break it down?
Well, unfortunately for the average person, it's not very deep. You know, people watch or listen to the news, or they get it through their social media. And unfortunately, it's very superficial. And they see the headlines. Sometimes the headlines are sensational and meant to grab their attention. Maybe they're not so accurate. And then they hear what their friends are saying, but or they hear what the let's just call them pundits who are giving their own opinions on the television or on the radio, but they hardly ever go into, you know, what the proposed law really says, right? Who proposed it? So in Moxie, you're able to actually see the legislation. You see a summary. You see who sponsored it. You see where it's at in the process. You can click on it. You can actually see the full text if you wanted to. You could also see from the sponsors, you could go to their page and you can find out their voting records. You could find out what committees they serve on. You can even find out who contributed to their campaigns. So you can go many other levels of detail. And of course, much of this information is available to the general public in a website somewhere, right? But hardly anyone ever really bothers to go there. But if you have it in your pocket and it's organized so that you see what really matters to you, in other words, your jurisdictions, whether it's the city commission or whether it's the county commission or whether it's the state, your state representatives or national representatives, you have it organized based on your own address so that you can focus on the things that you can have a difference in changing via your vote or via communicating to your elected officials.
And as I was going through the, you know, through the app again, I put in my address. So now it tells me all of my representatives again on all the different levels. So I know who's representing me if I need to contact somebody. Briefly, Caesar, how could Boxy fit into the school system, into that curriculum?
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that, because recently we introduced, well, first of all, we welcome anybody 13 years and older to use the platform. You don't have to be a citizen. You just have to be a resident of the United States. This is currently an American app. We will go international in the future, but you just need to be 13 years and older, and a U.S. residential address. Okay. Now, other social media platforms have presence of anybody, right? So a school, another organization can create their own channel, their own group chats, and so forth. What we've done with Moxie is we've enabled what we call authorized organizations. So it could be a school, could be another organization, to create their own private channel. So if they choose to, the administrator just checks a box and says, this is private. And so whoever wants to participate will need to receive the permission of the administrator. That way a student body, let's just say that they're minors, maybe it's a high school, maybe it's a college, they can go in and have their own discussions about public policy issues that are affecting them and feel comfortable in expressing themselves and only knowing that it's the people that are either students at the school or administrators.
So it's also creating those conversations with people. We got an interesting comment on Twitter. And again, you can always find us at WLRN Sundial. Don Richard says, I love this, but oy, rate my city employee. That idea could go so wrong. Just witness next door, an app that became a place for scammers. And yes, public employees are paid by us, just like teachers paid with our tax dollars. But I could see so many ways for this to be another idea paid with good intentions. Tony, I'm going to let you respond to that. Don has a concern. I mean, you're still in the beta, you know, setup here for your app, but how do you handle that concern?
Well, I think Don actually, you know, hit something there, but that's, I think, more applicable to the first version, the first iteration of CityGrader. Where we essentially put all the employees and departments up on a website, and because we wanted full transparency and full accessibility. And yeah, you have what we call the Wild West, where people would say all kinds of untoward things about people or maybe make things up. And we didn't have a way to keep this in check. And we always tell people that the vast majority of the content that was posted on CityGrader never actually made it to the public site. So that's really the reason we've turned it into an enterprise system that the cities have control over. What these QR codes do is these QR codes are non-repeating. So if a particular building inspector, for instance, at the city of Miami has 300 business cards in his pocket, each card has a different code, a unique code, and they're non-repeating. So when a citizen then scans the code, they take that survey, they can't pass it on to someone else and say, hey, pile on because this guy was terrible, or pile on because this guy was great. It's a great validation or verification mechanism for us. We also look at things like IP address, timing, some of the metadata that comes in with the survey so that we can help give the survey a score. So the cities will know, look, if a survey comes in from someone who lives in Bellevue, Washington at 12:01 a.m., it's probably not a high quality survey.
Right.
If it comes in at 3 p.m. and it's coming in an area that's and it matches the content of the survey, then we think that's probably something you should look at.
I see. So
And
just remind people again when you're going to be releasing the full app again.
So CityGrader will be in June. That's going to be something that the cities administer themselves, and the app itself will be. It's available now, but it's just limited to Coral Gables, and it's very narrow in its focus. But the full app will be available in the fall, between September and October of this year.
All right. Two interesting ways to look at civic engagement. Do it through an app. Why not? Everything else we do is through an app. I've been speaking with Cesar Melgoza, with Moxie, and Tony Newell of Resource City. Cesar, Tony, thank you so much. I really appreciate the insight.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And best of luck to both of you. Maybe this is the way to go. By the way, we've been hearing from you, and you can reach us in so many different ways. But Greg emailed us. He says, quote, my kids say their teachers are afraid to get deep into present-day issues in civics classes. They get the basics. Oh, Greg, that's depressing. Thanks for telling me that, though. I appreciate it. Looks like maybe we should have a civics class on this show one of these days. By the way, you can find the best way to reach us, you know what, is the Sundial Text Club. I've been telling you about this. It's the easiest way to get a hold of us and let us know your thoughts. You could also be part of future programs. Just text the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, hello to 786-677-0767. Still to come, it's a difficult time for the film industry with COVID impacting theaters. How are independents surviving? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. All right, let's face it. It was such a strange night for the Oscars last night, right? It reflected what might be the oddest year for Hollywood and movies in general. Box office revenues are down 80%, and more films than ever before have gone from skipping the theater, going straight to streaming. Independent theaters and films have also been forced to adapt. Here in South Florida, one of those is O Cinema. Vivian Martell is the co-director of O Cinema. They're celebrating their 10th anniversary, and they have a new fleet of virtual reality films that we're going to talk about. Vivian, great to have you back.
Oh, thank you. Great to be back.
I would sing you happy birthday. My producers don't allow me to sing on air. So happy birthday, though. Congratulations. You know, O Cinema got its start with the Knight Foundation Arts Challenge back in 2008, right? I mean, that was like right when the big recession hit. What was going on?
Oh my goodness. Yes. I mean, it was amazing. And then, the bottom got kicked out. So it took us a little bit longer to open up. As a matter of fact, we opened in 2011. So, Miami used to be a great place to be able to say, I've got this idea, and people would, immediately want to fund and participate. And in 2008, it was really difficult. So we had this idea, and people would say, yeah, okay, talk to me about it when it's further on, which was normal. I mean, everybody was suffering. But we did find that as soon as we had a location, the doors started opening, and that was wonderful. And then just an outpouring of the community supporting and making this happen. So that was wonderful.
You think about like what you've been through this year. You had the pandemic and how that changed everything. Can you compare the two? Can you compare what you went through for the recession that slowed down your launch to what you've been through this past year and a half?
The one thing I can say is that when you draw the line, arts and culture remain really important to the people in Miami-Dade County, and having it be affordable and accessible became like our guiding light. And it actually, you know, then and now, I feel that people want to support and want to reach and want to have that kind of color in their life. And that held true back in 2008 and 2011 when we opened, and it holds true now. Obviously now there's a lot more channels and a lot more people have pivoted to virtual. The movies are being released on the screen in a day and date of release. So things are a little bit more challenging, I would say, yeah. But at the same time, it's kind of inspiring. In 2008 through 2011, we were still working with the celluloid or celluloid based films. and now that we are in, the DCP era with digital downloads, it's lowered the bar in a good way, in terms of having more people have the ability to tell their stories.
Right, right. I want to ask you about this because you talked about the virtual. And so this is where things have shifted, at least for O Cinema. Now you're going in this direction at least a little bit. But explain to me what the virtual, the cinema works are that you have lined up.
Okay. So we reopened our doors, all the COVID safety guidelines in place in April. We just, and back then we pivoted back in this time last year, we pivoted to virtual cinema, which is, movies on demand, if you will. And then what we just launched last Friday was films in VR, where we are actually created an O Cinema theater in the VR world through Altspace, and we are screening curated shorts, monthly events there. So we're trying to be really nimble in the industry as it keeps changing. I think it's our duty to change with it and be available to provide, arts and culture for everyone.
Do you think that's the future of the business, or at least with independent theaters, is virtual? And this is, again, for anybody who doesn't know, it's you put on the headset and you enter that story, but it's three-dimensional. You feel like you're in it. You feel like you're part of the story.
To answer the first part of the question, the industry is changing so much that who's to say? I think that we'll never walk away from a community gathering of people watching films. It's been around forever, and I think it'll continue to be, maybe in a different way that we're not seeing now. Maybe it'll be a combination, those Disney sensation rides with, 360, it's raining and you get wet, who knows? As a nonprofit in this community, providing, independent first run films, I think it's important for us to stay, the cutting edge of what's happening. And just to go a little bit further in the virtual reality aspect, you can don a headset, but right now you can also enter virtual reality on your PC computer. So if you're a gamer, there's also the possibility of engaging in that way too. So, there's many pathways to this VR world.
Yeah. I'm talking with Vivian Martell. She's the co-director of O Cinema, the independent movie theater based in South Florida, celebrating 10 years in business. We're talking about operating an independent theater during a pandemic, and also talking about technology and how it's changing the game and how we will be watching movies and how we're going to be entertained going forward. By the way, you can find a link to the list of movies now playing and coming soon to O Cinema. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. So again, it's this virtual reality series. It's called Welcome to Our World that you just launched. One of the films is Ice on Fire by Too Long. There's fire dancers surrounding you, performing, kind of weird considering we've been practicing social distancing. So it's a little bit strange. But do you think VR is, when you think about it, like this kind of the shorts, not full movie, but shorts, that's going to catch on, that could become popular?
Well, I will say that there are not a lot of venues that take it upon themselves to show short films in front of every film. Usually you'll see that when you have like the Oscar shorts, like animation and action that are bunched together, or when you see them in film festivals, being able to offer them in this platform, I think is unique and gives a nice taste. When you go into our world, you get to explore, you get to walk the red carpet, you get to fly to our islands in the sky. So it's not just walking into the big top and watching the film, but it's also an interaction with the within the environment. So that's interesting. This is Ocinema VR 1.0. There are plans to actually have headsets available this summer at Ocinema where people can come in. So if you don't have a headset and you want to, you know, experiment and play in VR space, we'll have that capability, like I said, midsummer, as we continue to develop this platform. I think that we'll be able to have, you know, full-length feature films, but we'll be able to show, you know, the filmmakers are also changing with the times, not just the industry, right? The artists are. So people are now creating in 360 video. Mm-hmm. Or 180, and we want to be able to offer that as well. So the next phase would be having the technology in place, to launch something like that.
You have another film too, is Quarantine Rain by Carla Fort. I hope I'm saying that right. a lot of movement in this one. She's dancing in the rain, then underwater. Contrasts with her elderly father's slow movements in his walker. Tell me a little bit with these two films. What stood out? Why did you decide on these two?
Well, the focus was creating an experimental short series, and I wanted to touch about like the beauty of life, death, transformation. We are not the same people we were this time last year, and how can I put that in a curatorial, altogether statement where you can celebrate the joy and the not so great things that we've suffered through. In particular, with Carla Forte, a local filmmaker, if you notice or you will see in that film that the only thing that you see when you see her dancing is the part of the mouth and nose that we have had covered this whole year. And her movement through water. And the water is transformational. It's cleaning, but it's also oppressive. There are moments where she's underwater. And, she's had to take care of, her father and her father, elderly father who's immunocompromised, and this his routine of health and keeping healthy and her responsibility. And it kind of made that like a powerful statement for me in terms of what, like I said, we've all been going through one way or another in terms of being safe for ourselves, for our family, and for our community.
Yeah. I can't remember the last time I was in a movie theater. But I'm excited to get back. I really am. But look, it's not to say we've had movies. There was a point where a lot of films stopped or they didn't release. And now they're all starting to come back. They're starting to come out. But really, I'm wondering how, especially independent film has been doing, and really, how they're moving forward, because we're almost out of this. We're not yet, but it feels like we're getting close.
Yes, I feel, as an exhibitor of film, our situation last year was that everything felt like it was bottlenecked. There were a lot of films that were held back, a lot of films that could not be made because of the pandemic. So I think it'll be interesting to see, yes, now that we're going into this new normal, what it's going to look like in terms of what's the art film pipeline or the independent film pipeline. I think that, when you're given us something to do, a project to do, and you're constricted, I think what it creates is like a need for more creativity. I hate using the think out of the box cliche saying, but we get to expand and maybe laterally think and create from a different place. And I think that what we will be seeing, it's my hope that what we will be seeing is some amazingly creative movies moving forward. Yeah. Hopefully it won't be all like pandemic related, but like how pandemic has influenced you, right? I mean, I read somewhere there was an art opening of like, COVID art opening, and they were having ventilators on display in LA. I was like, you know, maybe that's not the way to go.
No, exactly. No, if anything, I think the independent scene is where you're going to find that creativity. Big studios obviously have to follow a different kind of model. Vivian Martel, co-director of O Cinema. Vivian, again, happy birthday to you guys. Congratulations on 10 years.
Thank you. So happy to be here.
All right. Have and by the way, day. You as well. By the way, you can find a list of all their upcoming projects and films on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Can't wait to get back to the movies. Well, that's our program for this Monday, April 26th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, vaccine hesitancy remains a big problem in Florida. In a state of 22 million, only 8 million have gotten one shot. Public health experts are concerned that the state could face a second wave if more people don't get their shots. We'll have a panel conversation about strategies to break that hesitancy. Plus, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we've been reading Joan Didion's Miami. The book captures life in the Magic City back in the 1980s. Tomorrow, we're going to hear from a Miami Herald reporter who toured Didion around Miami back then. All of that coming up on the show tomorrow. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks again for listening. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.